in the United States, he is quoted a great deal, and it's hard to find an American friend who didn't study Tocqueville in some way at school, even if they've forgotten. So Tocqueville is sort of everywhere. And what I understood from them was that he was this French aristocrat who got it, who came to the United States in 1830 and thought how wonderful American democracy was. When I read Tocqueville after this, I discovered the truth was much more complicated. He believed that there was no getting away from democracy. The revolution had occurred. He'd lost, family. He'd lived with the trauma. You might wish there was not going to be a democracy in the future, but it was not going to be stopped. And one of the things he was interested in America was seeing maybe if there was a way he could find where this would be okay, if there was a place for him in history. And of course, he had this terror of the mob, the tyranny of the majority, which sounds the most horrific, reactionary sort of thought. But as I spent more time with him, I thought it was not perhaps such a reactionary thought.
I wonder what sort of times, what were the political times when you started reading him? Who was in charge when you? You started reading him?
It was the Gang of Thugs, of course. It was Bush and Cheney, or should I say Cheney and Bush. And by the time I'd finished it, one could look at the possibility that Palin would end up being the President of the United States once Dick Cheney... We always wanted him to die, it would not be a good thing if she'd been the vice president. And you read Tocqueville and you see among the many things that he was worried about that I was worried about, he's worried that somehow that because of the will of the majority, a great mad moron might come to rule. And I saw time and time again the things that he was worried about were things I was worried about. Culturally, so many of us sort of despair almost daily, that we're swimming in some great sea of cultural crap, and that there is, important and serious culture, but for the most part, what we have made for ourselves is sort of rather like what Tocqueville was worried we would make for ourselves. In the 60s, I remember passionately believing and wanting that popular art could be great art too, and when serious people started to pay attention, say, to something like the Beatles. That seemed to me like a triumph because the popular was being regarded as serious by serious people. And I was so pleased to have a short story at Australian Women's Weekly and so on. But I don't really feel that's the way it's gone.
It's not quite the utopian result you might have hoped for. But so how did this very still resonant historical figure become the fictional character? Can you tell us a bit about that? Olivier de Gaumont. He has about 17 names, but that's more.
I had experts on naming, standing by in Paris, who told me how to make a good Norman aristocratic name by cutting the half of this off the half of that. Anyway, I didn't want to write a history. Many excellent and more or less excellent people have done that. So there's no room for me there, and I don't do that, and don't know how to do it, and don't want to do that. But I was really interested in the argument, and really what I wanted to set up was this sort of argument about democracy, because Tocqueville's sort of right and he's wrong. And I wanted to have an argument between two characters who were both right and both wrong.
And so times, if you know a little bit about Tocqueville, when it's really very close to the historical record.
Yes.
Indeed, I mean, his relationship with the priest who teaches him and so on is very, as far as I could tell, very precisely drawn from the history.
Oh, yes.
At other times, you cast aside all the facts. How do you go about sort of deciding what stays and what doesn't?
Well, I wanted it to work so that the people who did know about him, the historical figure, would recognize what I was doing. In the history, Tocqueville doesn't go to the United States alone. He goes with Beaumont. It's Beaumont who writes the book about prisons and also a novel about slavery. So the thing that the historian reading it will recognize is there's a character in this book called Blackville who stands pretty much for Beaumont. And so very early in my book, Blackville is killed. So the minute you hit that point, if you're somebody who's concerned about history, you know what the author's up to. In other words, the author is up to right. messing with it. Mm. If you know about Tocqueville, you will know that and you'll appreciate what I'm doing. If you don't know that, I still hope you're having, you know, your mind fed and that you're laughing a little too.
There's a character Watkins who produces the botanical illustrations of birds in America, which are clearly those he's produces the work of James Audubon. Yes, but he has nothing to do with
not a single thing to do with Audubon. But I remember the poor dead Audubon was terribly helpful, you know, in terms of what it takes to produce a portfolio of engravings in that period. So
right.
So I relied on that particular bit of history.
And was a great original American artist.
Oh, absolutely. Mm.
The story kind of tells the story that both Olivier and Parrot trying to negotiate their relationship with America, and one of them, I won't give away too much, but they end up at very different points. I wonder where you've been living in the States for, 20 years now?
Mm.
Where's your relationship at with your adopted country?
I'm the author of my adopted country. I think the book represents the argument. I mean, one cannot be very settled about what it means to be. I mean, I have an American passport and I have an Australian passport. You know, I vote in elections. No, I'm politically active, but much less than I should be, and I'm continually guilty. You're living in a mad place. You're living in a very beautiful place. You're living in a place that produces seas of crap and pollution and some, you know, extraordinary art and extraordinary human beings. One lives there and is frightened by it. But if you're living in London, you should be frightened of it too. So, yeah, really the situation's not all that different. It's not a settled one. But I live in New York, and I like to live in that city. I sort of arrived there not by voting or making a political choice, but through the accidents of my personal history. You know, who knows? You know, I might be living in Kuala Lumpur just as easily, or even more easily than the United States. So I don't know. I think the argument contained by the book probably represents my feelings in total.